Biological Sciences and former chairman. Tape one.
That what you asked me at the end of the last time was that you wanted to hear about the short and unhappy presidency of John Lee.
Yes, I do want to hear about
but it's all related. So I'll start wherever you want in terms of,
well, wherever, all right. I think if you can give your views or your viewpoint of what actually happened at Oyster Bay to create the situation that I found when I came in September of 62.
All right, let me just ramble on and I'll try to provide some kind of context within which we can understand what went on. I think it would be important, first of all, to correct a common misconception, which there have been many errors in fact and concept which have been advanced during this in the publicity related to the 30th anniversary celebrations this year. They range from characterizing the operation at Oyster Bay as being a teacher's college to even having incorrect statistics on numbers of students, data first classes, and all kinds of things like that. The college on Long Island was never a teacher's college. It was not in the category of colleges which then each of which then had a dean in Albany, and the colleges of education had their own dean. His name was Herman Cooper.
Yes, I remember him.
And I'm distressed that the publicity often calls it a teacher's college because it wasn't. And the
it was not under Herman Cooper.
It was not under Herman Cooper. That's right. It was, as a matter of fact, it was in a completely separate category. It was always listed with the professional colleges of the State University. Here, for example, is a listing of the various units by category. Here are the colleges of education. Here are the other professional colleges. And here's the College of Long Island at Oyster Bay. So from the very first, it was never a teacher's college. And the reason was that it had a function which was far broader than the preparation of teachers. And the bulletin introduction in those years are very instructive, I think. And from the bulletin of 1961, for example, which was before our first graduating class completed its 4 years, it says, established in 1957 at Oyster Bay as the State University College of Long Island, this new university center has built for excellence from its inception, starting with programs designed to educate scientists, mathematicians, engineers, and teachers of science and mathematics. In other words, this was one of the many functions which we served from the beginning. Our initial focus was in science and mathematics, but preparation of teachers was one aspect of that. academic.
That's
sorry.
been singled out in the publicity.
Well, it's just been described. We've just been described as open as a teacher's college at Oyster Bay in 1957.
Yeah.
And I think that's the reason I think it's unfortunate is because the teacher's colleges in those years, the colleges of education, as they were later called, had a reputation which was not along the lines that we were trying to move. They were not liberal. They were not academically distinguished. They were seen as trade schools for the preparation of secondary school teachers, period. And each one of the colleges had a focus. Brockport, for example, specialized in the training of teachers for physical education, and that's what they were known for. Potsdam for music, and if you wanted to become a teacher in one of those fields, you sought out the State Teachers College, which was appropriate. Let me read on here a bit. Academic programs were based strongly on the liberal arts and sciences, and students were required to meet the highest standards of scholarship. It was recognized from the start that preparation of distinguished professionals in these fields required more than specialized training. It required university education in its best sense. I think that's a good introduction to try to place the role of Leonard Olson and Alan Austell in the picture, because they started from the premise that in order to train scientists, engineers, or any other professionals, that the first job was to establish a good educational foundation in what we considered then and now as liberal education and the liberal arts. And they strove in every way possible to emphasize, stress, and reward the development of a curriculum which would help to bring about that result. We aim to produce educated human beings, literate, able to communicate their ideas to others, and to be able to feel at ease in the humanities and the social sciences, as well as in the natural sciences and mathematics. That is a difficult goal. It was brought about in those days by emphasizing a lot of activities that required the development of those skills. Classes were primarily moderate in size and discussion classes. There was a great deal of written work in every class, some of which, as I mentioned last time, evaluated by people in more than one division. It is, it's quite distressing to me personally to see how far we have slipped from those early goals in our present situation. It is extremely depressing to have a senior student come in after being asked to write a paper in a course and be told that he had never been asked to write a paper in any course in 4 years in this institution. I think that's just one index of how far we have slipped from
what
the
major was he?
Well, these were often science majors, but the main point is that never in the humanities, never in the social sciences, even though they had minimum requirements to take in those fields, were they asked to do a paper. And that's one of the penalties you pay by having very large lecture classes and taking multiple choice exams. So when they come to write a paper, they learn to their astonishment that they don't know how to write. They don't know how to put a sentence together. They don't know how to punctuate. They don't use good grammar. Their spelling is atrocious, simply because have failed miserably in making opportunities available to students to practice these skills. Writing is not something you take courses in. Writing is something you do, and you have to do a lot of it. And we did a lot of writing in the early days at Oyster Bay. Now, part of our goal was achieved by the curricular structure. And the curricular structure was one which was developed so that it would be a common experience for all students. And so all students took Humanities 1 and Humanities 2, and all students took Social Sciences 1 and Social Sciences 2, and all students took Natural Sciences 1 and Natural Sciences 2. Because regardless of what they planned to go into eventually, the idea was that they have a common core of educational experience. What we call a core today, how hard we were working, we have a course called CORE. That is not a core of educational experience. In those days, students actually had something to talk about with one another. They had common readings, they had discussions in different sections of the same topics, and so they could compare how different instructors approached the same topic. We had open visitation between classes and instructors so that you could visit any class at any time and see what's going on. Not done for assessment of the instructor, but done for purposes of self-enlightenment and acquaintance with what was actually going on educationally with the students. That is the best way to find out whether the students are becoming educated
or not. Access to different points of view.
Different points of view, and to actually see if, as I did at one time, I attended a Humanities 2 course during an entire semester with Harold Ziskin as instructor, and he was such a skillful teacher. And you can see the minds of the students beginning to encompass difficult and sophisticated ideas, and you could compare where they started at the beginning of the term with where they ended up at the end of the term. And it was for them a magnificent experience, and it certainly was for any of us who sat in and observed as well. The importance of this is that Leonard Olson and Ellen Austell took a personal interest in the nature of the education that the students were getting, not in terms of how many courses they were getting, and not in terms of calculating totals of hours, but in terms of what was actually happening to them intellectually. The examination schedule was, in the early days, was quite different too. We had a final examination at the end of a year, so that the students were asked to not to parrot back facts, but to react in written papers on the materials that they had covered over the entire year.
Was there one at the end of the first semester?
There was in some courses. We had them in science and mathematics, but I think in humanities that was at the end of the year, and so on. There are certain institutions still in this country that I believe that do not even examine you at the end of the year, but examine you in the fall of the next year, so that you have the summer to let things settle and ferment, and so that you think in terms of larger concepts and not in terms of a lot of facts which you have to memorize. So I think that was a striking difference in the approach, in the educational approach that characterized the early days at Oyster Bay. And as I also think, even though Alan Austell was technically dean of students, he took as intense an interest in the academic faculty. He was fully aware of what was going on, and of course he perhaps even had a better insight because he talked to students who were in trouble and students who were not, and learned a lot about what was going on in classes that way.
That explains where he is now.
He is now retired, but he was the dean of the new school in New York City, and he's now chancellor. They created the position just for him.
Is that right?
Upon his retirement. So he's chancellor. He is chancellor of the new school, but he was dean of the new school prior to that time. Let me turn then to what happened in around 1960 and 61, when our mission began to enlarge. The State University had renamed somewhere around 60 or 61. College of Long Island as Long Island Center.
Yeah.
So it was called State University of New York Long Island Center. And that was about the time that they decided there should be four university centers around the state.
The master plan is dated, I think, 60.
That's probably, yes. Well, I don't know when it actually was implemented as far as we are concerned. I have two documents here, both 1960-61. One is called College of Long Island, one is called Long Island Center. So that dates it approximately. And I think it was probably handed down, not as officially as a news release from Albany or something like that, the way such things sometimes happen. At any rate, that expansion of mission began with the addition of an engineering authorization for Stony Brook. And there was the same kind of concern expressed at that time about engineering education as for other kinds of education. We had a large meeting which was participated in, and I guess in a sense sponsored by, although I don't remember the details of this, General Electric. And they came and we had many discussions about the nature of what an engineering curriculum should be in the 1960s, which we were entering. Prior to that time, engineering had been classified in the traditional ways into mechanical, and electrical, and civil, and so on. The General Electric men believed that was an unfortunate way to go, and that teaching engineering students the specifics of civil and mechanical engineering was futile if you didn't end up in a particular kind of engineering company that used those particular applications. They thought instead that students should be very well founded in the basic sciences and mathematics, along with some fundamentals of engineering type courses. Material sciences, for example, was something that hardly existed in those days. Electronics, their position was that if you give us a student who is well educated in the fundamentals of all of these areas, we can train them in the applications in a period of weeks. You give us a student who is professionally train in a particular area and we want it for a different area, we have to train him from scratch. And so they proposed essentially a new engineering curriculum at the time, which we endorsed.
Hardware free.
Well, that original goal has been compromised, of course, in the succeeding years, but there are still some vestiges of that around. Now,
who brought in GE? Do you have it?
Well, I think Leonard did. I don't know what the chain of events was there. I still have it somewhere. They put out a beautiful brochure just for this meeting where they indicated the outline for discussion that we would all engage in. And it was so harmonious with,
okay, go ahead,
with what we were trying to do. It was so harmonious with what we were trying to do that, of course, we endorsed this principle for the organization of an engineering curriculum. The next job was to recruit a dean of engineering. And through a series of events that I have no personal knowledge of, a man from North Carolina State by the name of John F. Lee appeared on the scene to be interviewed as the as a candidate for the Dean of Engineering position. Now, John Lee was a very charming, verbal person, and in his interview with the council who was involved at that time, and with the faculty, he made a very good impression.
See now, was Judge Sullivan chairman then, or
yes,
was Ward Melville still chairman?
No, Ward Melville was honorary chairman, and William J. Sullivan was chairman,
yeah,
of the board.
Yeah, right.
And I, to be honest, don't think that let's see. Here is the 1959-1960 bulletin, and Melville was still chairman at that time. But I think that was about the time when he became honorary chairman, and Judge Sullivan became chairman, acting chair, or actual chairman of the council. At any rate, such appointments as that were for the upper positions were actually recommended by the council to
even the deans.
Oh yes. And along the way, as I say, I was not involved in this, he made, John F. Lee made such a good impression that some people began to ask, why don't we, since we're also looking for a president, why don't we consider him as president? And that, I suppose, that fell upon sympathetic ears, since it was, I'm not sure, just what stage the presidential search was in at that time. It was about the time we wanted to recruit a president before the move to Stony Brook. And so it was in its early stages. Now, that must have taken...
Let me stop you there. Just
yes,
a sec.
Right.
Because, and here I don't remember who, but somewhere in the interviews, somebody said that Leonard Olson made such an impressive set of recommendations for Lee hearing that people began to say, well, why don't we make him president?
Quite possible. Quite possible. He was a very impressive guy. No question about it. In any case, however it came about, he was recommended for the presidency and was approved by the council and was approved by the Board of Trustees in Albany. Now, that must have been sometime in the fall of 1960, so far as I don't know the exact time frame there. At any rate, he was due to arrive on campus in at the beginning of the second semester. So in the 60-61 academic year, he arrived on campus.
Early in 61.
Early in 61. I think, to be precise, it was in February, early February of 1961. Now, about 2 weeks after he arrived on campus, he called a special meeting of the faculty. To be precise, it was called on Tuesday, February the 28th at 3:30 in the afternoon in the Great Hall, which is in Cole Mansion. The business of this is a notice from the secretary of the faculty, who was Bill Lister at that time. The business of the meeting will consist exclusively of an address by the president. So we all gathered in the Great Hall and were addressed by President Lee. He later distributed a detailed copy of his remarks. And they run to, well, I'm not sure how many pages here, but 15, 20-odd double-spaced pages. And there is no question about it, it was a tour de force. It was setting out the goals for the institution, presenting the challenges of a new president, talking about the mission of Stony Brook, dramatizing C.P. Snow's Two Cultures and the Scientific Revolution, saying such things as the scientific and humanistic cultures must be joined, those were his words, stressing the quality of the faculty, and the need for a distinguished faculty of teacher scholars, addressed the question of the responsibility of the faculty in some detail, kinds of committees and so on, how the faculty would be organized in terms of departmentalization. We provided tables of organization at that time, talked about the challenges of the move between from Oyster Bay to Stony Brook. He applauded the fact that we had an absence of the evils of big-time intercollegiate sports, called them flamboyant sideshows. He said, all of the right things. And then he went into administrative organization and took up the whole question of communication between administration, faculty, and students. Communication is a lifeblood which nourishes and purifies both bones and flesh. Then he talked about the what his administrative structure would look like. And he first addressed the post of Dean of Faculty. was the post that Leonard Olson was then going to occupy. He was never intended to be president. He was to start the institution, and then he would stay on as dean. He was always dean. He was never called president. And he says that he should be the president's alter ego, but should be unreluctant to play the devil's advocate on behalf of the faculty. Must have the moral power to keep uppermost in the president's mind what is truly best for the primary mission of the university. He is, in a very real sense, the president's chief advisor and confidant. Then he talked about the Dean of Students, Academic Senate, Student Government, all of which was well in place at that time. He talked about the academic divisions. The concept of
four.
He did. I'll get to that in just a minute. Talked about the graduate.
All right. See that?
Mm-hmm.
The red thing.
What's the time of one side of the tape?
60 minutes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I certainly will go on longer than 60 minutes.
Okay.
Well, as I was saying, in this initial address that he made to the faculty on February 28, 1961, he was outlining his ideas for the organization of the institution and its future, and he addressed the question of the graduate faculty. And then turn to the question of the College of Arts and Sciences. I hadn't remembered this. The loose and unbalanced confederation of divisions should be joined and strengthened under the leadership of an imaginative academician. The humanities division is comparatively strong, followed by the division of social sciences, which, however, lacks a diversity of viewpoint due probably to its small size. And then he points out the division of science and mathematics is weak, particularly in the biological sciences. I assume that's why he thought there should be a separate division of biological sciences so it could be diversified and increased in size. At any rate, he did propose a Dean of Arts and Sciences as soon as possible with four divisions: Physical Sciences and Mathematics, Biological Sciences, Social Sciences, and Humanities. New and bold departmental structures should be evolved within these divisions. Then he went on to the College of Engineering and actually endorsed the report, which I referred to earlier, which is called Suggested Engineering Curriculum for State University on Long Island, and supported the elimination of what he calls the anachronistic and meaningless departmental specializations such as mechanical engineering, civil engineering. Ad infinitum is long overdue in many colleges of engineering, and proposed the elimination of departmental structures along the lines proposed there. Then he went on to talk about some of his ideas, including the naming or establishment of three distinguished professorships in each college with salaries of the order of $25,000, which was big money in those days. These professorships could be financed entirely from endowments or from a combination of basic university salary and endowment. Comment on research, that it should be conducted by the faculty in all cases, should involve the participation of students. And then, enunciate the principle that no faculty member's basic salary, whether in whole or part, should be contingent upon the availability of external grants for research. Talk a little bit about consulting responsibilities, And then finally commented upon Sunwood, which he calls the beautiful faculty club presented by Mr. Ward Melville, and refers to his gift of $25,000 per annum for 6 years for the operation of the faculty club. He keeps talking about a first-class club. President Lee was, so he liked things first-class. He would only go to the finest restaurants. I remember I once went to lunch with him at a elegant Italian restaurant in Glen Cove, the name of which escapes me after all these years, but it was, I must say, one of the fanciest lunches I'd ever had, and he certainly took that as a matter of course. And he tells some of the posts that he hopes to fill. I see there's an interesting statement here. Any university that starves either the humanities or the sciences or technology is a medievalist institution, not having the intelligence to know it is dead or dying. And he talks about a number of other posts which he hopes to fill. And then points out that 4 degrees, the AB, the AM, the SM, and the PhD degrees have been approved by the Board of Trustees and have also been approved by the Committee on Higher Education, the Board of Regents. Formal approval of the Board of Regents is expected in the very near future. Those were, as I recall, those were general authorizations for those degrees and did not involve any particular subject matter or focus.
Okay.
Going to double the library staff, new admissions director, launch a number of funds, drives, and so on. And then he closes by saying, during the past few months, your administration has made a Herculean effort to provide you with the type and level of support you will need to create a university to stand with the finest in the nation.
That's a quote from the Heald report.
I see, yes. Only the faculty, through its genius and effort, can make the dream of a distinguished university come true. You have an exciting and demanding task to perform. Now, I think it's fair to say that, sorry?
You said that was saying all the right things.
All the right things. I think it's, I think everyone who attended that meeting was very pleased by what they heard. They thought that they had chosen the right man and that the future was bright. President Lee addressed a group of that size in a what I would consider rather imperious or pompous manner. That was just his nature, but he was really put on quite an elegant appearance and certainly said the right things. Well, as a part of this administrative reorganization, the Division of Biological Sciences was created, removed from the Division of Science and Mathematics, and I was appointed chairman of that division. We were not consulted about that at all, but we took it on as a challenge and as an opportunity to expand the role of biological sciences. We made this announcement in Science Magazine and other national media, and I think we attracted quite a bit of attention to the fact that the division had been created and that we were planning to expand rather quickly in a number of areas. The honeymoon with President Lee not last very long, however. The divisional chairman ran into problems almost immediately. The president behaved in a very autocratic way. He almost completely ignored faculty governance. He made decisions unilaterally, which were then announced. It was very difficult to know exactly where you stood as a divisional chairman in charge of a certain component of the academic program. It also turned out that he was could be quite vindictive and did not hesitate to ridicule or punish those who did not fall into line with his ideas. He also had great and unrealistic ideas about a lot of things. He had big dreams, apparently. One of the things he wanted to do was establish a helicopter link between the Oyster Bay campus and the Stony Brook campus so that people could be shuttled back and forth with great ease. And he also had envisioned the size of the Stony Brook campus as being one which warranted the building of a circular railroad around the campus so that people could move from building to building in an expeditious way. These ideas and others, I suspect, began were certainly attracted a lot of attention in Albany. And although I can't know for sure what budget he submitted in the spring of 1961, I can almost guess that it was far beyond what the coffers of State University at that time could afford. We tried over the months of March and April to accommodate to the president and in particular to follow his suggestions. I'll just put aside a bit of a chapter with one of the examples in biological sciences for the moment to give you the main outline of what happened. The divisional chairman, who at that time were Harold Ziskin in humanities and Jay Williams in the social sciences, Bill Lister in science, physical sciences and mathematics, and myself in the biological sciences, at about the same time came to the conclusion that it was really impossible to serve as the academic link between the administration and our own faculty members. And we had a number of meetings and eventually decided that in good conscience we could not continue in those positions of administrative responsibility. So we decided that we would resign our posts. We didn't start out to make this any kind of a concerted effort, but the more we talked about it, the more we realized that the problems were very widespread on the campus, not only in our own divisions, as we had thought. We requested a meeting with President Hamilton, the divisional chairman. And we received a memo addressed to Dean Olson, Dean Irvine, Professor Lister, Professor Jay Williams, Professor Erk, Professor Ziskind, from President Lee. Subject: meeting in New York City with President Hamilton and President Lee. President Hamilton and I request your presence at a meeting to be held at the offices of the State University of New York in Manhattan at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, May the 27th. A station wagon will be available in front of Coal Hall to transport us to Manhattan. It is scheduled to leave at 9:20 a.m. The purpose of the meeting is to afford President Hamilton an opportunity to outline the responsibilities of this administration, the changed character of the institution, and to offer his encouragement to all of us in this trying period of adjustment. Well, we all converged upon Manhattan. I can't remember, truthfully, whether we rode in the station wagon or not. But at any rate, we all converged upon Manhattan and met with President Tom Hamilton and President Lee. President Lee asked us one by one to indicate our reactions to the first several months of President Lee's administration. Bill Lister, I think, did the best job. He was secretary of the faculty, the best job in detailing what we found problematical in terms of faculty governance, not being able to communicate with the president, having numerous instances of decisions made without any kind of faculty involvement, decisions which dramatically affected the academic program and the members of the faculty, and ended by submitting his resignation in writing. And then the rest of us followed along and gave our own versions and verified what in fact had been said. And we all submitted our resignations around the table at that day. President Lee and, so far as I remember, Dean Irvine said nothing at that time. And Tom Hamilton listened impassively during all of this presentation. At the end, he said, "This is the saddest day of my life." And he stood up, and we stood up, and the meeting was clearly over.
No discussion back and forth after that.
No discussion. As a matter of fact, we rode down, we happened to ride down in the elevator with Tom Irvine. I think Lee stayed behind, if I remember. Rode down the elevator with Tom Irvine, and there wasn't a word spoken all the way down. And I don't know, I remember what floor it's on, but a very high floor. and so we parted. That my letter of resignation was dated on that day, I suppose, May 27th, and it was not until in July sometime that I got a response. And the response came not from Hamilton, but from John Lee, who said, July 28, 1961, "President Hamilton has approved my recommendation that your resignation as chairman of the Division of Biological Sciences be accepted. Please consider the effective date of your resignation to be the date of this letter. My hope is that we can now move forward towards a solution of the many problems with which we are confronted. I shall work to this end." His response to the resignation of the divisional chairman was to abolish the academic divisions of the college and to adopt a wholly departmental structure. And it wasn't until later, I don't know when, that the divisional structure was reinstituted. Now I want to return to an interesting set of events which had to do with the then Division of Biological Sciences and later the Department of Biological Sciences. It has to do with a name that President Lee sent down to me as chairman of the Division of Biological Sciences from a man who was working as an associate program director, advanced science programs, special projects in science education section of the National Science Foundation. It appears that President Lee had called this man, whose name is Willis Pequeno, to tell him about his plans for the Long Island Center and to solicit his interest in becoming a candidate for a faculty position. Now the date on the letter from Pequeno to John Lee is March the 16th. So Pequeno was obviously contacted sometime before then. And in this letter, he says to, in this letter to Dr. Lee, he says, "I appreciate your call very much." So the Pequeno did not initiate the contact. "The plans that you sketch are of considerable interest to me. The possibility of sharing in the development of the distinguished institution that you envisage has fanned intellectual fires and screened off somewhat a rather provincial desire to return to California." Then he tells about preparing a hasty biographical sketch and so on. And he sent along a page or two of biological information. His main interest was developing electronic instruments for submarine turbulence studies. He got his PhD from UCLA and taught at Pomona College for 20 years before going to the NSF. And then from there, that's where we contacted him. Now, in his transmission of this letter, President Lee said, "I'm sending this material to you from Dr. Pequeno for, one, consideration of Dr. Pequeno as a possible advisor to your group, and or, two, a possible candidate for appointment to the faculty. I should like to discuss with you at the earliest opportunity what plans you may have for Dr. Pequeno's coming here, either for an interview or in some other capacity. The reason I ask this information is not in an effort to press his appointment with you, but simply because if it turns out that you're not interested in his services in the Division of Biological Sciences, I might very well be interested in him for the Institute of Oceanographic Sciences." So I invited Pequeno to come. He visited us on April the 25th and gave a seminar on May the 29th. There was scheduled a meeting by President Lee with the Council of Division of Biological Sciences, included myself, Bob Smoker, and George Williams, to discuss general questions of submitting a proposal relating to an oceanographic congress and to discuss the various possible candidates for a position relating to such a proposal. And Ralph Johnson and Pequeno were to be discussed, among others. Well, eventually, for reasons of the resignations that took place 2 days before, that meeting was then canceled, and the discussion of oceanography was postponed until the fall. I requested a reimbursement, an honorarium for Pequeno for his presentation at Oyster Bay, and it eventually came through and was forwarded to me in Boulder, Colorado, where I was for the summer working on the BSCS project.
BSCS, Biological
Sciences Curriculum Study.
Science.
Yes,
curriculum.
Which started in 60, and then I've been working on it low these many years, including just last two summers ago when I worked on another book for them. I forwarded to him in Washington, and this was under date of 26th of June. Now, he acknowledged that under date of July 3rd, 1961, thank you for your pleasant letters and the voucher. I trust that your BSCS work at Boulder will progress to the full extent of the hopes for it that you expressed to me in April. Early in August, I leave for the Pacific Coast, where I shall visit universities from Seattle to San Diego before leaving for Hawaii and the Pacific Science Congress. One of the valuable features of working with the foundation is the opportunity to meet a very generous sample of the academic community under favorable conditions. I send my best wishes for a profitable summer. Now, he did not once mention in that letter that he had been appointed chairman of the biological sciences at Stony Brook. Not a word. And on July 14th, the Bulletin of Long Island Center, Volume 1, Number 2, announces Pequeno's appointment as chairman of the Department of Biological Sciences, effective September the 1st. And on July 17th, I sent him congratulations and told him I had learned of his appointment in the bulletin. Well, Willis Pequeno was, I guess it's fair to say that his heart was never in that position, because he spent very little time on campus. He told us that he was trying to phase out his position in the foundation, therefore he could not teach any courses at Oyster Bay. And he had one or two faculty meetings which were really quite dreadful. And it became clear, I have notes on one of them, and it became quite clear that he had no interest in the department, and B, that he had no idea how to go about organizing or administering a department. We, in the department, got increasingly agitated by his lack of attention to the details. A couple of times when I met with him in his office, our meetings were always interrupted with calls from his stockbroker in California. What stocks to buy, what stocks to sell, what's the price-earnings ratio on this stock, and so on. And clearly, he was much more interested in that. In the meanwhile, there had been a lot of agitation on campus, and there had been disruption and student demonstrations on campus before the end of the year, mainly in support of Leonard Olson and Alan Austell. And
were they under attack by that time?
They were under attack. I can't remember the details of that, but one day the students all went out on strike and refused to attend classes. I think after one of these, I can't actually remember what stimulated that, but it may well have been Lee's success in getting Olson removed or transferred to Albany again or something like that. At any rate, both Leonard and Alan Austell felt they could not remain at Stony Brook, and they became part of a task force to advise the King of Jordan on the question of establishing a university in Jordan. And this was an international body, if I remember, which involved quite a bit of travel around the world and lasted for 3 or 4 months and terminated in a large report to the King of Jordan. So I don't remember whether it led to the establishment of a university or not. At any rate, Alan became
they were a
dean. Sorry?
They were off campus.
They were off campus, yeah. during the fall semester. Alan became a dean at the new school upon his return, and Leonard Olson became assistant to the president of the University of Chicago. His name was Levy, I believe. We don't know exactly, those of us in the trenches, so to speak, we don't know exactly what was happening between July and November, but the situation became increasingly tense, and especially between the president and Albany. And through a set of events that I have no knowledge of, John Lee was fired from his post as president, probably in November of 1961, early November of 1961. And his total tenure in office then had been